Good morning and welcome to the Talking Information Center. Today is Thursday, July 30th, and we have today's reading of the Boston Globe being read to you by Mary and Maggie. Good morning.
Morning, listeners.
Good morning.
This is Mary.
And this is Maggie.
And I'm going to begin on our front page today with No Sense of Urgency with State's Report on Guardians by Jason McLaughlin of the Globe staff. 2 years ago, the legislature gave state health officials an appointed directive. Tell us how to create a system of professional legal guardians to help thousands of people who cannot make medical decisions for themselves and some who languish in the hospitals unnecessarily. But the Massachusetts Department of Public Health has yet to produce that report, and as of this week, it is a year overdue. It is like the bombs going off all around us, said Dr. Eric Dixon, of the chief executive of UMass Memorial Health. For whatever reason, there is no sense of urgency. Currently in Massachusetts, the position of legal guardian, is effectively a volunteer job, yet with play a crucial role. Not only do they aid people in need, they also help rationalize healthcare systems. Those hospital patients who cannot represent themselves but are medically ready to discharge to a rehabilitation center, long-term care facility, or skilled nursing home needs a guardian to sign off. Otherwise, they occupy hospital beds intended for more acute patients, contributing to overcrowding and lengthy wait times. Healthcare providers said all of that. The Department of Public Health said in a statement that its recommendations were delayed by additional data gathering and analysis, that its report would be out shortly. The Department of Public Health is committed to supporting patients who cannot represent themselves, said Ann Scales, the agency spokesperson. This includes addressing the shortage of medical guardians as well as work to increase the number of people who have health care proxies in order to reduce the need for guardianship. Turn our pages here. She added that the state had spent $118,000 so far on contractor Eastern Resources Group of Boston to gather information for the report and communicate with stakeholders. Even the state representative who sponsored the law regarding the study of guardianship said he has not heard from the Department of Public Health why its recommendations are so late. It is not uncommon for the state agency to delay, said Thomas Stanley, a Democrat from Waltham. I think the common refrain is that they have all sorts of work to do and there's not enough time or resources. But Thomas Stanley added it's crucial for the legislature to have recommendations from the Department of Public Health if it wants to fix the current system. The Department of Health, Public Health's findings are expected to include a deep dive into financial impact of state-supported professional guardians, including an evaluation of possibility of paying the guardians through MassHealth, the state Medicaid program. Early in 2026, Paul Enzikos, a coordinator for the senior advocacy group Diligence Dignity Alliance, Massachusetts, petitioned the Secretary of the Commonwealth to compel the Department of Public Health to produce records related to the report. The Secretary of Public Health's Records Division told in a March 6th letter that it failed to cite a compelling reason to not release the records and ordered the agency to reply to Langzikos. He said the Department of Public Health has yet to respond to him. The Department of Public Health asserts that the records are exempt from The Department of Public Health, the records are exempt from release because they are part of the policy deliberation process and some are protected by employee-client privilege. Lenzikos described the report's delay as totally unacceptable. This fall, when new bills get submitted to the legislature, we want the benefit of this report so that the legislature asked for it a year and a half ago to inform proposed legislation. in a meeting last week with the Department of Public Health officials, including Public Health Commissioner Robbie Goldstein. Officials told Langzikos the report was done and was awaiting vetting by the Executive Office of Health and Human Services. Often people in need of guardians are those with conditions including brain injuries, strokes, or dementia, but they can also include severe mental illness or developmental disabilities. Known in the industry as boarders, patients who are ready to be discharged but do not have anywhere else to go cost hospitals in Massachusetts $400 million a year, according to the 2024 report from the trade group for the industry. In May, point in time, count, the Massachusetts Health and Hospitals Association identified 1,152 patients at 45 hospitals who were eligible for discharge yet stuck in hospitals. Massachusetts is among just 14 states without professional guardian program. Guardians are appointed by the probate and family courts to represent the best interest of the person who isn't able to represent themselves. A family member can be appointed as a guardian. Hospital petitions often start the process for patients who are boarders, along with the medical decisions. Guardians may coordinate clients' housing, financial decisions, and social services. A guardian is also often responsible for their clients until the end of their lives. An estimated 3,000 to 4,000 people in Massachusetts need a guardian but cannot get easily to get one, according to the 2025 report. Overall, about 29,000 people statewide are subject to guardianship as of 2025. Madeline Feist, a staffer for the Public Guardian Service and one of the state's few full-time guardians, carries a caseload of 18 to 22 people at any one time. Complicated cases require up to 20 hours of work a week. Madeline Feist has described her history with a client she named with the pseudonym Jack. Now he is 57 and was homeless in Randolph and living with untreated schizophrenia when she became involved with him in 2023. Initially, he was hostile and refused to work with Madeline. Over the past 2 years, she has found him a home through the Department of Mental Health, coordinated neurology and psychiatric appointments, and guided him through cancer treatments while navigating his Christian Science faith, which makes him wary of medical intervention. She sees Jack up to 4 times a month. "This really allowed me to do the case management I wanted," said Madeline Feist, a social worker with 30 years of experience. Guardians can receive compensation from the state, but that typically amounts to no more than $1,500 a year, according to the Massachusetts. Sorry, my paper is all double typed here. The few people who are willing to do the work for that little compensation, some that do manage to see their clients just once or twice a year. And the process of appointing one can drag on for months, said Karen Sullivan, Director of Social Work at UMass Memorial Medical Center. Without a guardian approval, hospitals cannot even transfer patients to long-term care facilities within their own health care system, said Dixon of UMass Memorial. One recent day, the hospital had 35 patients ready for discharge instead of occupying beds, many in the neurologic or trauma units. Those beds are needed to admit patients from the emergency department. In a domino effect, patients instead remain stuck in the emergency department, which in turn limited the department's ability to take in new patients quickly. This is harming patients in terms of their health, hurting emergency department patients, and hurting the finances of the hospital. Also back on our front page is the convention center chief pulls out of deal. John Barrows faced pressure after landing a $2 billion contract to build the Springfield Courthouse. This is by Samantha J. Gross of the Globe staff. Under immense pressure and a lawsuit challenging the deal, the head of the Massachusetts Convention Center Authority said Wednesday that he is divesting from the controversial $2 billion contract with the state government to build a new courthouse in downtown Springfield. Through his attorney, Interim Authority Director John Barros said he is also divesting from the company involved in the winning bid, Kojo Real Estate, which he owned with Conan Harris, the husband of U.S. Representative Ayanna Pressley. Kojo was part of a team dubbed Liberty Injunction that won the bid to build the project. Notwithstanding the fact that John Barros did everything right and complied fully with the law, he had determined that the significant public benefits will come from the Liberty Junction team's project, a beautiful new safe courthouse and an engine for economic development in downtown Springfield, outweigh his personal interests, said his lawyer, Gary Ronan. After years of complaints that the outdated courthouse in Springfield, built in 1971, was mold-infested and making people sick, the state solicited proposals for a new building in 2025. It received 10 bids, including one led by Springfield auto magnate Jeb Belice and another by Peter Pan Bus Lines executive Peter Picknelly, and a third by real estate investor developer Dinesh Patel. On July 2nd, Governor Healey's administration announced it selected Liberty Junction to redevelop a property about 1 mile from the current courthouse into a new regional justice center. Liberty Junction includes a Virginia real estate firm, F.D. Stonewater, and Kojo Real Estate. The general contractor for the team is Suffolk Construction, whose chief financial executive, John Fish, is a political heavyweight in Boston and major backer of Governor Maura Healey. Suffolk Construction was part of the Belice bid as well. The decision landed with a bang. Within days, Jeb Belice and Patel's teams sued the state agency overseeing the development, the Division of Capital Asset Management and Maintenance, and will be called DCAM, as its nickname is, and Liberty Junction, asked that the project be halted until their allegations of conflict of interest and other questions could be heard. They also alleged state officials had not been forthcoming with all the public documents about the bid process. DCAM earlier in July posted online what is said were all the documents. In a joint statement, Belice and Patel teams said they have news confirms that what we have said from the start. The selection of the irrevocably tainted and no retroactive exit can undo that after the contract is already awarded. Belice and Patel said, for this reason, the only fair remedy is to set aside this award and redo the procurement. The parties are set to appear in court on August 11th. On a separate matter, Governor Healey is scheduled to appear on Thursday in Springfield with John Barros and Matt Gorowitz, the state's budget chief, to announce the investment in the Mass Mutual Center, which the Convention Center Authority oversees. The Liberty Junction Group submitted a 266-page proposal to DCAM in October 2025, proposing a six-story building on the site of the former medical office across from the Hampshire County Sheriff's Office. Months later, on January 9th, his company's proposal under review at DCAM, John Barros was tapped for the convention center position. In addition to his private sector experience, he previously served as the economic development chief for former Boston Mayor Martin J. Walsh. Gary Ronan and John Barrow, who was John Barrow's attorney, said that he consulted with the Mass Convention Center attorneys as well as the state's ethics commission and was advised he could remain part of the Liberty Junction team and its proposal, but he should not participate in any disclosures with DCAM. Gary Ronan added that John Barrows never spoke with the DCAM officials about this project. Gary Ronan said that John Barros was told that he did not need to immediately publicly disclose his pursuit of the courthouse project because DCAM had not yet selected a winning bidder. He was told instead that he should file a disclosure if his team was selected. On July 1st, the day The day before his team was announced as the winning bidder, John Barrows filed a disclosure with the Ethics Commission, making his involvement in the courthouse project public. Under state law, state employees cannot participate in a bid for a state contract without making disclosure to the Ethics Commission. My role will continue to be that of a passive investor, Barrows wrote in his disclosure. As an equal owner of Kojo Partners, I will receive indirect financial compensation from the contract lease with DCAM. The lawsuit alleges that the root of the alleged conflict was the Executive Office of Administration and Finance, the budget office that also oversees DCAM. Matt Gorowitz, Governor Healey's budget secretary, is also one of the 12 members of the Convention Center board that unanimously appointed John Barrows as executive director. Matt Murphy, a spokesperson for Matt Gorowitz, said that the secretary had no involvement in the procurement and did not participate in the selection process. Police and Patel's lawyers want the court to rule that the state violated the conflict of interest law and declared the Liberty Junction team ineligible for a contract. A spokesperson for Governor Healey declined to comment. This project will deliver a safe and modern courthouse that residents and workers deserve while delivering the best value for the taxpayers, said Governor Healey. The panel that chose Liberty Junctions included Chief Justice of the Trial Court, court employees, and the DCAM staff. In their direction, they said that they had a proposal from Liberty Junction was strategically located, maximized usable space, and is the most fiscally advantageous to the state. But the mayor of Springfield, Dominic Sarno, said that he preferred a proposal along the Connecticut River from Picnelli at the Peter Pan Bus Lines executive. The DCAM process also included having a group of court employees rank the submitted bids. The Liberty Junction proposal was near the bottom of their list, said Hampden County Clerk of Courts Laura Gentile. The group said it lacked parking and had a layout plan that put two courtrooms more than two stories above the clerk's office and said it would take too long to build more than 3 years. Gentile, the clerk of court, said that John Barrow's decision to leave the project was a day late and a dollar short. In a big statement of its own, she said, it is a big statement on its own. This is too big a project for people to have these kinds of ethical questions. Kojo Real Estate was informed in 2023 that through it was involuntarily dissolved at the end of 2025 after twice failing to file an annual report with the Secretary of State's office. According to the state's business records, the business was received on Monday, 3 days after the Globe asked John Barrow's attorney about its legal status. Gary Ronan said it is not unusual for the LLC to be administratively dissolved and reinstated in this manner. It happens all the time. Typically, certificates of good standing are needed to apply for government contracts. John Barrows, who mounted an unsuccessful bid for Boston mayor in 2013, worked in commercial real estate since leaving the City Hall in 2021. As the Mass Convention Center Authority's interim executive director, John Barrows earns about an annual salary of $330,000. He also reported income from Civitas Builder. Yeah. I'm going to read this right next. No? Okay. Civitas LLC for consulting two Boston-based investment firms, according to his most recent financial statement. In a statement, Liberty Junction Principal Claiborne Williams lauded John Barrows' work on the project and his willingness to step back for the community's benefit. We wish him well, he said. Okay, moving on to fighting flame on the next section. and the world section, that is, fighting flares up on multiple fronts, risking an all-out war. Attacks involve U.S. and Iran and Saudi Arabia. Qasim Abdul-Zahara of the Associated Press wrote this article. Baghdad, the U.S. military said Thursday it had completed a heavy wave of strikes against Iran, conducted in response to an earlier Iranian missile attack on the U.S. base in Jordan. The latest barrage came after the United States partnered with Saudi Arabia to strike Iran back militia in neighboring Iraq, killing at least 20 fighters and 6 Iranian advisors. Central Command said in a social media post that over the span of 2 hours, the U.S. struck dozens of targets belonging to the Iran's Revolutionary Guard Corps, including the military command centers, as well as missile and drone facilities and coastal surveillance and defense sites. The new strikes came hours after President Trump vowed to hit Iran very hard and after it targeted a base in Jordan that hosts the United States troops. Iranian state media said that the 2 people were injured in the attacks on the island of Kisham in the Straits of Hormuz, and explosions were also reported in the Khuzestan province to the northwest. Elsewhere, drone strikes ignited fires on 2 natural gas vessels at the Egyptian port of Damietta, according to the British maritime security firm Ambrey. It was not immediately clear who was responsible for the strikes on the U.S.-owned floating storage facility and a Greek-owned tanker. No injuries were reported. The flare-ups on multiple fronts after several days of relative calm raise the risk of return to an all-out war. It is also underscored that the difficulty of winding down a 5-month conflict that has jolted the world's economy and is unpopular among Americans. The fighting was also so unlikely to add the concerns that the United States is further drawing down already diminished stockpile of sophisticated munitions needed to defend its bases and allies. Egypt, a close U.S. ally and regional mediator, is one of the only countries in the Middle East to have spared direct military action during the war. A strike Iran on it or its allies, if confirmed, would mark significant widening of the conflict. Asked during an Oval Office event if Iran was responsible for the strikes on the natural gas vessels, President Trump responded, "It's a little more of the same. In the meantime, we're going to be hitting them very hard because it's our turn to hit them," he said. Saudi Arabia had accused the Iraqi militia of firing drones against its own oil facilities over the past 2 days. An umbrella group of Iraqi militia initially denied the allegations, while another Iran-backed group, the Houthi rebels in Yemen, said that they had attacked the Saudi energy facilities as part of a separate but related conflict. Saudi Defense Minister Khalid bin Salman met separately Wednesday with President Trump and Vice President J.D. Vance, according to the person familiar with the matter. The White House and Vice President's office did not respond for comment, request for comments. The renewed hostilities sent oil prices spiking. Brent crude, the international standard, jumped 7.3% to $88.093 a barrel. Much of the attacks started on Tuesday. Iran's paramilitary Revolutionary Guard said it fired missiles at Jordan's Muwafaqeh Salty Air Base, a key U.S. military hub, in a statement carried by the state-run IRNA news agency. Jordan's military said 5 Iranian missiles had been intercepted and destroyed. The U.S. military later announced that American and Saudi fighter aircraft had struck multiple logistics and weapon sites in eastern Iraq in response to the alleged drone attacks on Saudi Arabia. The Popular Mobilization Forces, a coalition of primarily Shiite Iranian-backed armed groups that is officially under the command of the Iraqi military, said at least 20 fighters were killed and 32 were wounded in an overnight strikes. Six Iranian advisors were also killed, according to the two Iraqi militia officials, who spoke on the condition of not being identified because they were not authorized to speak. Iran's deputy governor for political security and social affairs in Markazi province told Iranian state media that four advisors were killed. Before the latest eruption, mediators had expressed optimism about bringing the United States and Iran back to the negotiating table. An interim agreement collapsed in recent weeks over the renewed fighting in the Strait of Hormuz, a crucial waterway for global energy supplies that Iranian attacks have again effectively closed. A regional official said mediators were still trying with both sides to restore calm and get ceasefire back on track. He gave no details on whether the progress was being made. Maggie?
Yeah. Okay, on the home front in the Metro News, the first article is state moving to protect immigrants. The legislative deal comes weeks after the latest ICE shooting by Chris Van Burskirk. Massachusetts state lawmakers struck a deal Wednesday on a bill that would protect immigrants from civil arrest in the courthouses and schools and build upon a nearly decade-old court decision that restricts local law enforcement from helping federal immigration authorities. Democrats who led the Massachusetts House and Senate, as well as the Governor Maura Healey, this year coalesced around proposed protections for immigrants amid the Trump administration aggressive deportation push and after federal immigration agencies fatally shot two people in Minnesota. The legislative deal comes weeks after immigration and customs enforcement fatally shot another man, this time in Maine, and at this time when tens of thousands of Haitians in Massachusetts are losing temporary immigration protections. State Senator Cindy Freeman, who helped negotiate the final proposal, said that the bill bolsters protection for immigrants at the time when people are losing their rights. We know that people are being hurt needlessly, and we know that there is great fear and trepidation throughout the Commonwealth because of the acts of the federal government, said Cindy Freeman said, telling the State House. At the center of the bill is an effort to state lawmakers to block immigration agents from detaining immigrants in certain sensitive areas. The agreement would ban ICE agency from making warrantless civil immigration arrests at the state courthouses, public schools, child care centers, and the health care providers, said Cindy Freeman. On the next page. Lawmakers said the legislation also empowers the government to bar the immigration arrests in ICE operations in non-public areas of state facilities, a measure that would codify a portion of the executive order Governor Healey would sign either in this year in the wake of the Minnesota shootings. Cindy Freeman and State Representative Dan Cahill, a Lynn Democrat who helped negotiate the agreement, said the bill affirms and expands upon 2017 Supreme Judicial Court ruling known as the Loon decision that bars local law enforcement from detaining someone based solely on suspected civil immigration violations. State legislature also agreed that on a measure that would prohibit say in local enforcement officials from asking someone about their citizenship status during a routine stop unless it's necessary to enforce criminal laws. Dan Cahill said the negotiators were led to believe by local laws enforcement agencies that asking about immigration status is not important to the police when they are trying to assess what's going on at the scene. Clearly, we do not want to have law enforcement try to utilize someone's immigration status as a way of coercing or badgering individuals, said Dan Cahill. Friedman said that the bill bans the state from entering into the new deals with ICE, known as the 287G agreements, that allow local authorities to act as immigration agents. But the legislation, like the executive order that Governor Healey signed earlier this year, leaves in place the only existing agreement of its kind in Massachusetts between the State Department of Correction and the federal government. State Representative Andy Vargas, the chair of the Black and Latino Legislative Caucus, said the caucus support kept the deal because he argued it could help those who have not been convicted of a crime. Whether you like it or not, we're in harm reduction mode here. The reality is that we want to make sure that the hardworking people in our neighborhoods aren't swept up in these processes of looking for people who've been committed serious crimes, said the behavioral Democrat. Dan Cahill, with the longstanding agreement between the state and the DOC and the federal government, allows for the safe transfer of people facing imminent deportation. We don't want ICE having a search for those folks in our communities, including my community in the city of Lynn, he said. Over the North Shore cities, 104,000 residents, nearly 38% are foreign-born, 46% are Hispanic or Latino, according to the federal data. We certainly don't want them using it as an excuse to go and not only to seek that individual, but anyone who happens to be around them, he said. So Friedman and Cahill said the hope is the House and Senate to vote to send a bill to Governor Healey's desk within the coming days. State lawmakers are up against a Friday deadline to place bills into six-member negotiating committees before the traditional stretch of formal law making ends this year. Legislators can still take recorded votes on anything that emerges from the negotiated committees, including the deal on the immigration-related bill through early January. Democratic governors across the country have been grappling with the specter of immigration surges in our own state since President Trump took office last year. Federal immigration agencies have launched multiple concerted operations in Massachusetts. Cindy Freeman and Dan Cahill said that they also give victims of unjustified action by federal immigration agencies the ability to sue in state court when their constitutional rights have been violated. The provision mirrors a separate bill filed earlier this year by State Senator William Brownsberger, a Belmont Democrat. As a state legislators, we swore an oath to protect and defend these constitutions, and therefore we must do anything we can to ensure our constitutes have access to the rights enshrined within them, Cindy Freeman and Dan Cahill said in a joint statement earlier in the day. In the radio interview, as agreement was announced, Governor Healey said that the immigration-related bill is about protecting residents, protecting our communities in face of just unbelievable, unconstitutionally, I think, un-American actions out of Trump's administration on immigration generally. I hope this gets my desk this week, she said. And the next article is New Maine Law. Laws will work with ICE. Restricted sharing cooperation with federal agencies by Camilo Fonseca. Weeks after the fatal shooting of the Colombian migrant in Biddeford, Maine, a series of state laws took effect Wednesday that limit how local agencies work with federal immigration and enforcement agencies. The three laws restricted the cooperation of state and local law enforcement with federal agencies, such as the Immigration and Customs Enforcement. They also bar the sharing of sensitive information by public schools, hospitals, and state libraries, as well as private landlords, according to a memo by the American Civil Liberties Union of Maine. Mike Kabibdi, policy director of the ACLU Maine, said in his Tuesday press conference that the laws would make Maine communities safer by building trust in the law, local law enforcement, and ensuring every person can get help in an emergency regardless of their immigration status. People are more likely to report a crime, serve as a witness in court, and call for help if they know that their police are not acting as deportation agents. The act that addresses the law enforcement corporation effective bans 287G agreements, type of contract that formally allows local enforcement to exercise immigrant enforcement powers. Police also now barred from calling in immigration authorities to traffic stops and from assisting in Border Patrol stops conducted without a warrant. The law also prohibits state jails from holding people arrested for civil immigration violations. Until early this year, the Cumberland County Jail served as a major holding center for immigration detainees in New England. Those detainees were abruptly transferred out of state in January after the local sheriff publicly criticized the ICE detention of one of his recruits. Maine jails are also barred from communicating with ICE about individual release dates and from holding individuals on the ICE detainer who are otherwise eligible for release. Local law enforcement is still required to cooperate with federal authorities regarding the specific criminal investigations. The Maine Chiefs of Police Association did not immediately return a request for comment on Wednesday evening. Another law taking effect Wednesday prohibits public officials, such as school administrations, from allowing immigrant agents access to education or health care records. Third, the law bars landlords from using personal information of their tenants, such as immigration status, to threaten or blackmail them. Tenants have a right to feel safe and secure in their homes, said Ben Gaines, legal director at Maine Equal Justice. Homes have always been enjoyed a higher legal status for the protection of the privacy and safety of people who enjoy within them. Legislators passed the Police Act by a narrow party line vote in June 2025. Governor Janet Mills delayed the signing bill until December, allowing it to pass into law without her signature. Maine's Public Safety Commissioner directed state police to limit their collaboration with immigration authorities shortly after, and despite the law not coming into effect until July. Federal immigration enforcement have intensified in recent weeks, culminating in the fatal shooting of Johann Sebastian Duran Guerrero, a 25-year-old immigrant from Colombia, on July 13th. The moment reminded all of us that the decisions and the role the government plays in our lives are not abstract, said Ruben Torres, advocacy and police director for the Maine Immigration Rights Coalition, at Tuesday's press conference. They affect our neighbors, our families, and trust that people place in the institutions that are meant to serve them. State officials in Maine have condemned the recent fatal shooting in a law enforcement certification as a part of a visa application for Duran Guerrero's family. The Maine Attorney General Office cited the state's criminal murder and manslaughter statutes as a basis for their investigation. His family, through their attorney, has said that they wanted to see the officials bring criminal charges against the agent responsible. Okay, we're going to change it up a little bit, and we're going to talk about issues on cancer. Fighting to shine light on a deadly disease. Rare breast cancer that claimed the CAPE actress is a focus on the proposed law. The bill, spearheaded by Cape Cod residents, aims to improve education around inflammatory breast cancer while honoring the impact of a local actrix. Marnie's Law is now on its third reading at the Massachusetts State House, with the bill needing approval by July 31st in order to move out of legislative session. Should it become law, the bill would mandate that undergraduate nursing programs across the state expand their curriculum to include education about inflammatory breast cancer, which typically forms with no visible lumps and often doesn't appear on standard mammograms. The bill is named after the actress Marnie Robidas, known especially as Marnie Schoenberg, and a 14th-generation Cape Cod native from Barnstable who died on 2022 at 37 from stage 4 inflammatory breast cancer following a misdiagnosis. Marnie Robidas' cancer was at first mistakenly diagnosed as metastasis, a breast infection that typically affects the breastfeeding individuals, affecting giving birth to her own daughter in 2019. Doctors didn't discover her cancer until 2020, when it was terminal. Proponents of Marnie's Law hope to help educate nurses on inflammatory breast cancer to avoid future misdiagnosis. Her father, John Schoenberg, who was led by the efforts to pass the Marnie's Law, recalls Marnie's Robidas saying that she started chemotherapy and she wanted her to take a journey and make a difference. That's the basic for me continuing this. I want her life to make a difference, to Mr. Schoenberger, noting that he would drive his daughter to and from medical appointments for 2 years after she was diagnosed. A performer since she was a young girl, Marnie Robidas would go to develop a successful career as an actress. She earned a Daytime Emmy Award nomination in 2010 for her role in the soap opera As the World Turns and appears on shows including Royal Pains as well as Blue Bloods starring Boston native Donnie Wahlberg. While Marnie Robidas was battling cancer, she began Marnie's Army, an online group to help spread awareness about inflammatory breast cancer to other women. The advocacy all really started with Marnie, said Zach Robidas, her husband. Even in the middle of the hardest moment of her life, she wasn't just thinking about herself. She was thinking about the next mother who would be going through the same thing. After her death, Mr. Schoenberger wanted to honor Marnie Robidas' life and impact on Cape Cod community. He started a memorial bench at the favorite beach, Millway Beach in Barnstable. He then helped launch the annual Marnie's March on Millway to raise money for cancer research in Cape Cod theater music. The idea for Marnie's Law came from a family friend in Barnstable, native Josh Goofman. We connected with Mr. Schulberg following her death. He had initially connected with Robidas' siblings while theater at Barnstable High School together and was inspired by Schoenberger, a veteran, to join the military. When Koopman was overseas in the Army, he would always receive holiday and birthday cards from Schoenberger. Robidas' pursuit of acting inspired Koopman to do the same. After the Army, he went into back to school for DeSales University for acting, but Robidas also attended. She was kind, like a little sister to me and a best friend, and she was an inspiration for me for acting school and leaving career behind. He later moved back to Cape Cod and now owns a popular pizza shark restaurant in Harwich, along with his location in Chatham and Dennis. After losing contact for a year following Robidas' death, Kaufman reconnected with her family over games from pool in Schoenberg's garage, and every Wednesday night the two would play two rounds catch-up. Initially, they talked about Kaufman's movies and his work, and over the weeks, conversations switched to do more honor for his story.
Continues on.
That kind of where with this second phase of his started, Fuhrman said, just trying to find a way to attack the disease and attack the cancer in a different way in order to carry on her legacy, but also try and save lives in any way we could. This transformed their week pool games into meetings about Marnie's Law. Kubin joined the board of directors of Marnie's Army, which Mr. Schoenberg had set in a non-profit to raise money for cancer research and began working on the various fundraising efforts. Every May since 2024, Pizza Shark had donated $1 to non-profit for every slice of pizza sold throughout the month to honor Marnie's birth month. This May, the chain raised $3,600 and had raised $10,000 since starting in the fundraising efforts this 3 years ago. Since a Pizza Shark restaurant is located inside the Chatham Orpheum Theater, the theater has been able to screen Marnie's movies and discussions on inflammatory breast cancer to raise awareness and to honor her work. It also shows a mockumentary of the Golden Scallop, which Kubin, Robidas and her husband and other Cape locals made together 12 years ago. Among strong communities support, Schoenberg and Kubin knew that the legislation was the next step in order to help the less saved lives. At some point, it was decided that it was real to making a difference from Marnie's journey in education, Schoenberg said. The lack of education is so dire and the results are so devastating that that's where we're focused. Schoenberg and Kubin found a support from Barnstable State Representative Kip Diggs and Hartley Lundy, who co-filed the bill in January of 2025. Lundy connected with the mission from the personal case, having lost her sister-in-law to cancer after a misdiagnosis as well. For me, this is not just a matter of filing something that was critical for the future of any woman that experiencing this diagnosis, but also had personal impact on my own family, Lundy said. The bill has so far been met support from across Massachusetts. It passed unanimously in the Committee on Public Health and now sits before the House Committee on Bills in the third reading. With serious medical condition like breast cancer, time is of essence, and early detection is crucial to patient outcomes, Dick said in a text message. This bill has potential to improve the quality of health care for breast cancer and patients saving lives. Marnie's Law hasn't just sparked a conversation in Massachusetts. New Jersey introduced a similar bill in December of 25. And Schoenberg has also met with the Pennsylvania legislator. We're making much more progress, much more quickly than I could have ever dreamed, said Mr. Schoenberger. And as they wait to see whether the bill will move out of the legislative, Schoenberger and Kubin are proud to see awareness and support that they generated. I'm kind of just two old vets trying to figure out how to attack this, Kubin said. I'm just blessed to be there by their side.
I'm going to move on to a little of the in the business section. Mass House to vote on a primary care bill. Adds new AI rules, plans to boost oversight by Allison Kuntz of the State House News Service. The House Democrats advanced a highly anticipated primary care reform package Wednesday that also imposed new guardrails on the use of artificial intelligence, bolsters oversight of pharmacy benefit managers, and creates an accelerated process for state public health regulators to vet certain determinations of need applications. House Speaker Ron Marino previously voiced skepticism over the Senate's primary care bill that passed on a 35-4 vote last month. But the redrafted approach the House Ways and Means Committee released on Wednesday morning echoes a critical provision from the state Senate establishing primary care spending target. The legislation is up for a vote Thursday today, according to a joint statement from Marino, Ways and Means Chair Aaron Mikulewicz, and Healthcare Financing Co-Chair John Lawn. For many Massachusetts residents, an unstable rise in health care costs made it initially difficult to access and afford basic health care services, the House leader said. To confront the challenge, the legislation made critical investments in primary care by strengthening reimbursement rates, investing in our primary care workforce, expanding timely access to appointments, and by easing the administrative burdens that contribute to provider burnout. The bill cleared the Ways and Means Committee on a 19-0 vote. Representatives Michael Casson, John Marisi, Joseph McKenna, Kelly Pierce, Tom Simola, Allison Sullivan, Almeida, Marcus Vaughn, and Stephen Exeros served their rights in the poll. Representatives Patricia Duffy and Ryan Hamilton, Russell Holmes, Christian Kastner, Lindsay Sabona, and Alan Silva, and China Tyler took no action. Under the House Ways and Means bill, primary care should represent 9% of all health care spending in 2030. The target would climb to 12% in 2033 and 15% by 2036. It's a longer runway than the Senate bill, which envisions reaching the 15% target by 2030. A primary care payment collaborative within the Division of Insurance would establish at least one advanced primary care payment model aimed at supporting value-based care, moving away from the traditional fee-for-service structure. Instead, the model promotes predictability, captivated monthly payments for members. Insurances would be required to embrace at least one model and offer it to contracted primary care providers and provide organizations. Going beyond the scope of the Senate's bill, the House and Ways bill regulates the use of automated utilization review tools defined as AI, an algorithm, or another software used to conduct or generate information relied on in utilization review based in whole or in part on medical necessities. The bill clarifies the automated tools that cannot be sole based for adverse determination, and that a decision must be made by a licensed physician or healthcare professional. Insurers and utilization review organizations must disclose the use of automated tools on the website and outline in written notices whether the tools were used in adverse determination. Building on last session's prescription drug reform law, the House Ways and Means bill requires insurers, pharmacy benefit managers, and affiliated entities to apply to at least 80% of estimated prescription drug rebates in order to reduce patient cost sharing at the pharmacy counter, according to the House summary. The bill also boosts oversight of affiliated entities and other organizations that are vertically integrated with pharmacy benefit managers. The bill also lowers out-of-pocket costs by ensuring that patients benefit from the prescription drug rebates at the pharmacy counter, and that insurance companies cannot deny patients the full benefit of the prescription drug coupons. The legislation also invests an initial $25 million into a new workforce development fund. Community hospitals could also benefit from expedited determination of needs, if they're looking to expand primary care, behavioral health, maternal health, and services in underserved communities. The project would receive priority decisions issued on 60 days after the application is filed. And that's all the time we have today to read the Boston Globe. This is
Maggie
and Mary saying thank you for listening.
Thanks for listening to Lowell Association for the Blind's Lab Radio. Lab Radio is a member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. There are many ways to listen to Lab Radio. Request a free specialized receiver, or for more information about our radio reading service, call Lab at 978-454-5704. You can listen to Lab Radio anytime by dialing 1-631-359-9069. Or visit our website where you can tune into Lab Radio at LowellAssociationForTheBlind.org. Thanks for listening.